is key in the crackdown strategy of Al-Khalifa. And our people start to understand that uniting, having their political right, is key to prevent such movement without their consent.
Well, the regime responded to the demands of the people with suppression, as we all remember and see, leading to the martyrdom, injury, and arrest of many Bahraini activists. Yet the people's presence in the squares, defending their rights to freedom of expression, to having a better constitution, remained unabated, especially recently with the start of the Al-Aqsa flood operation, and when they went to the streets to show support and solidarity with the Palestinian people, especially in Gaza, as the world sadly watches the ongoing genocide in Gaza. What can that solidarity change in the reality of the normalization process between the Bahraini regime and the Zionist entity?
Well, when it comes to resistance, everybody have to play a role in resisting Zionism, American policy, and in supporting Palestine. Solidarity, public gathering, demonstrating, Shia and Sunnah demanding to stop normalizing with the Zionist, supporting Palestinian right, is vital as it feeds resistance of people. It supports the resistance in Palestine, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Iraq also. It gives clear picture that people around this area is all up to support Palestine and to fight the Zionist aggression and American policy. Moreover, it helped a lot curing our society from sectarian poisoning. It provided clear evidence that Al-Khalifa regime have no legitimacy whatsoever. It also prevent American Zionist penetrating our society. So the society, the more society demonstrate and public come in public gathering, the more they oppose American and Zionist, they prevent American and Zionist from penetrating the society.
Mr. Fayez, most of the Bahraini opposition leaders have been either eliminated, have been exiled, or are imprisoned, despite them choosing a very peaceful approach to trying to change the political system in Bahrain, in dealing with the continuous crackdown against their own families and their own communities by the Bahraini regime forces against its people. Is there a prospect to maybe change the current approach, how the protesters or how the opposition is dealing with the Bahraini authorities? And if not, if there's no will to change the current approach, which is a very peaceful approach, what other options are there left for the people of Bahrain to ensure they secure their own liberties and at least stop the sectarian discrimination against their people?
We see people around us, different country, use the different approach. In Bahrain, the peaceful approach as a strategy to resist Al-Khalifa regime, to demand our right, is set by the highest religious and political leader, Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ahmed Qasim. I or other politician may have our comments. I or other politician may consider a different approach. However, him, Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Ahmed Qasim, has the final call to change this approach. And because we trust him, we obey him, we will be always behind his word. We will be always obeying his decision. Our option is to continue steadfast, building the required strengthening our society, our people. We succeed because our people trust us. We succeed because our people, in their mind and in their heart, are still free. The idea of revolution, the idea of having a democratic system in Bahrain is still alive and proven to be the right way forward for Bahrain and its people.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Ali Al-Fayez, for being with us. Mr. Ali Al-Fayez, Bahraini political activist and human rights advocate, for sharing your thoughts about the 13th anniversary of the Bahraini revolution this year. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about 42 years of Hezbollah in Lebanon.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, 42 years have passed since the inception of Hezbollah, which started with limited resources, but with a committed Islamic ideology. It outlined the paths of cultural, jihadist, political, and social work, proving to be the compass guiding towards nationalism, resistance, unity, and serving the people. For 42 years of jihad, Hezbollah faced Zionist Israel, which destabilized the region, occupied Palestine, and parts of Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, considering its army an invincible force. However, Hezbollah defeated it with resounding defeats in its three wars on Lebanon. The latest is still ongoing in support of our brothers and sisters in Palestine. More details in the following report.
The Islamic resistance in Lebanon, Hezbollah, has completed 42 years since its founding with full support from the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the beginning of its military operations against the Israeli occupation and its opposition to the Western and American project in West Asia. The Lebanese resistance's characteristics have been completed, transferring Lebanon from a stage of being overrun by the occupation army by land, air, and sea, to a stage of imposing deterrence equations and defining the rules of engagement, leading to a clear vision of the central goal of the imminent downfall of the temporary entity. Hezbollah's work since its inception in 1982 has been focused on deterring the occupation in every war or aggression, with each new equation entering into force and forming the basis for subsequent ones. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah had previously divided the stages of deterrence as follows. The beginning was between 1984 and 1985, when the Zionist enemy was forced to withdraw from wide areas in Lebanon as a result of a large number of qualitative and major operations carried out by various factions of the Lebanese resistance, with Palestinian resistance also participating in that stage. The scene changed after 1985, when the Israeli enemy tried to advance into Lebanese towns and villages and faced very violent confrontations. The third stage of deterrence evolved from 1992 to July 1993, where Hezbollah reached a high level of deterrence with some violations occurring. In the 1996 aggression, the deterrence of 93 was confirmed, and it was a prelude to the liberation of the year 2000. From 2006 until the very beginning of the current ongoing war of the Al-Aqsa flood, there had been no Israeli airstrike except one on a border point between Lebanon and Syria, and two strikes of drones, to which Hezbollah responded to all of them. Now, since October 8, 2023, Hezbollah has been in direct military engagement with the Zionist occupation in support of the Palestinian people currently undergoing genocide in the wake of the glorious Al-Aqsa flood operation against the occupation entity. Thus, over the course of 42 years, the resistance has accumulated its strength and restrained the movement of the occupation and its military capabilities and technological advancements, which are often portrayed in its media and publicized as superior. Hence why the Zionist occupation does not dare to take any full-scale action against Lebanon, fully aware that any miscalculated action towards Lebanon will be met with an equally devastating response. At Zionist Israel's current trajectory, whether in Gaza or the southern Lebanese front ignited in support of Gaza, Hezbollah has made sure that the enemy government will find no other way but to accept the conditions of the resistance in Gaza. consequently reaching a point of announcing a cessation of aggression on Gaza and proceeding to negotiations, which is Hezbollah's one and only condition to stop its retaliatory attack against Zionist Israel in South Lebanon.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Sheikh Dr. Sadiq Nabulsi, Professor of Political Science at the Lebanese University. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Nabulsi. Now, the founding of Hezbollah in 1982 during the Lebanese Civil War and the Israeli invasion of Beirut, with direct assistance from the Islamic Resistance, from the Islamic Republic of Iran, marks its inception, the inception of Hezbollah, the foundation of Hezbollah. But over the course of 42 years, it has evolved into one of the most formidable non-state military forces globally. While military strength is very crucial, and it is important in such cases, its resilience against Western hegemony stems from a very specific, robust ideology. What factors do you think contributed to the durability of this ideology in the face of ongoing Western dominance that really never stopped?
The creed of Hezbollah stems from the values of authentic, eternal, steadfast, and immutable Islam. Resistant to wavering, weakness, and change, belief in Allah and His power is a fundamental pillar of this strength possessed by Hezbollah. Some may think that spiritual convictions hold no value, but today, major armies around the world are discovering that spiritual, faith-based, and ideological aspects are the foundation of any power, equation, or strategy. Therefore, all the achievements of Hezbollah to date are built on these spiritual principles and on this creed that elevates the value of sacrifice and jihad in the path of Allah leading to martyrdom. The resistance in Hezbollah's view is a movement of faith, awareness, cultural and political consciousness. It is an integrated theoretical and practical content that directly reflects on the performance of the Mujahideen and directly mirrors the achievements of the nation in confronting its enemies. Hezbollah has reached an advanced stage of spiritual perfection and military prowess, which has enabled it to become a regional power, shaping the balance, traps, and modern history of the region.
You see, the religious doctrine of Hezbollah that you are speaking about and its supporters is mainly Shia Islam, specifically how they entitle it as the Twelver Ja'fari Shias. During the global conflict in Syria, we did see that Hezbollah experienced a decline in support, especially from Arab and Islamic allies and countries, due to ongoing takfiri counter-resistance propaganda and efforts. However, following the Al-Aqsa flood operation and the engagement against the Zionist entity in support of the brothers and sisters in Palestine, there has been a resurgence of support for Hezbollah, both in the Arab and Islamic world. How do you interpret this shift?
Hezbollah has never presented itself as solely a Shia party. It formed its popularity and built its credibility as a resistance faction against Israeli occupation of Lebanon, and as a movement fighting for the rights of Lebanese, Palestinians, and the oppressed and marginalized in the region and the world. Arab and Islamic masses, as well as other peoples, gravitated towards it due to its steadfastness, seriousness, and legitimacy of its religious, national, and humanitarian principles. Adherence to Islam and to the Palestinian cause are two foundations for attracting this large number of followers. Regarding its involvement in Syria, it was a necessary engagement, because the fall of Syria would have inevitably led to the downfall of the resistance in Lebanon, and subsequently the resistance in Palestine, and even the collapse of any genuine Islamic banner. What affected the Arab and Islamic mind during the global war on Syria, with delusions and concept confusions, was indeed very dangerous. What happened proved that Hezbollah was on the right side, standing against the project of fragmenting the nation, demolishing its rights and ending the central issue of the nation represented by the Palestinian cause. Hezbollah was a force against the new ignorance represented by the Takfiris, and it had to stop the series of the nation's losses. What Hezbollah did in Syria was a clear retaliatory approach against the realities of Takfiri violence and the achievements of its ignorance and bigotry. there was a Western project being prepared to be implemented in our region, a very dangerous project threatening the future of the entire nation. The goal of this project was to lead the nation to a collapse with no revival afterward. Hezbollah realized these risks and paid a high price in blood and reputation, all to ensure that the nation doesn't lose its basic compass and its causes, foremost among them the Palestinian cause.
Now, Dr. Nabulsi, with everything that you have explained so far, we see some sort of a complementing relationship between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Hezbollah in Lebanon, to a point that some might consider Hezbollah to be a proxy of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And Hezbollah, to be honest with you, keeps fighting this notion and keeps finding itself in a position to defend itself against such accusations and allegations. But does it not make sense that Hezbollah is actually an extension of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps?
These are the terminologies of the enemies. In the enemy's approach, there are terms like masters and slaves, while in their approach, there are only sovereigns and proxies. As for Hezbollah and the rest of the free resistance factions in the region, they are all one body, with one goal, and they all work diligently to expel occupations and rebuild the identity and dignity of the nation. Hezbollah and the other non-state resistance movements in West Asia operate in line with the interests of our Arab and Islamic peoples, and according to the concept of national sovereignty and national choices. I ask this: does America have the right to establish entities and support civil organizations, providing them with all the resources they need to wage soft or hard wars here and there, or to achieve goals that have no relation to the unity and interests of the nation, but rather work under the banner of hegemonic projects? Is it really permissible for colonial forces to freeze hundreds of thousands, to undermine the entire economy of our region and spread rumors and sedition within it? Resistance forces do not have the right to unite, cooperate, and coordinate their efforts for the sake of peace and security for their peoples. We have the right to question why the forces of evil cooperate with each other. They have no right to raise issues or create confusion about the cooperation of resistance movements in West Asia. Leaving reservations here and there, the whole world is now moving towards alliances, small and large, out of necessity and interest. So why shouldn't Muslims in this region, including the resistance movements, unite to expel every occupier from this land?
Dr. Sadiq Nabulsi, Sheikh and Professor of Political Science at the Lebanese University, thank you very much for your insight and contribution to our show in this very important discussion about the history of Hezbollah in Lebanon and its ideology. Ladies and gents, thank you very much. We promise to give you the latest updates from West Asia right here on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson: the significance of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z. Dear listeners, this is Ali, and in today's episode of A to Z, we will be talking about the Islamic Revolution of Iran and who Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, was. Brothers and sisters, Imam Khomeini, even after his demise, and it's been around 40 years that, alhamdulillah, this Islamic Revolution has came about, Imam Khomeini is still being discussed. Imam Khomeini, his thoughts and his life and his stances, they are still being analyzed by the world, not just by the Muslims. So in order for us to be able to understand what this Islamic Revolution was all about, we need to be able to understand Imam Khomeini. And how can we understand Imam Khomeini. We can understand part of Imam Khomeini by understanding his stances, his principles. Those principles, brothers and sisters, are a guiding light for all of us. These principles, majority of them, a heavy majority of these principles, are eternal. These principles, where did Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah Ta'ala Alayh, drew these principles from? We have to look at that. Well, if you go and read the ahadith and the traditions of Ahlul Bayt, the Prophet and the Holy Imams, you would see that the source for everything Imam Khomeini stood for, it was in those traditions. If you open up Quran and if you look at the principles explained and defined in Quran, you will see that Imam Khomeini took his principles directly from Quran. So this was the source of those principles that Imam Khomeini stood for. One of those core principles we're going to be talking about today, and that is Imam Khomeini and opposition to America. Brothers and sisters, the Imam considered America to be the mother of all evils. His exact statement, which is well acknowledged by millions today, is America is behind all that's gone wrong. Welcome back to your listeners. Brothers and sisters, the Imam also declared the United States of America to be the great Satan. This conclusive stance of Imam Khomeini is acknowledged by the justice-seeking masses around the globe today. If you look at the slogan that gets raised by all the free-spirited people around the globe, it is Death to America. There was a stance of Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution. In Arabic, this slogan is translated as Al-Mautul Amerika. In Farsi, this slogan is translated as Marg Bar Amerika. In Urdu, this slogan is translated as Murdabad Amerika. There are so many other languages that we can talk about, brothers and sisters, where this slogan has actually made the foundation for people to understand what America is today. Imam Khamenei, because there is a misconception here that a lot of people, a lot of times, bring up sometimes out of their innocence, sometimes because of lack of understanding. And that is, saying death to America means death to American public, death to American nation. Brothers and sisters, let me read a saying of Imam Khamenei, who is the flag bearer of the Islamic Revolution today, who is the leader of the Muslim Ummah, and who is the Waliyafaqih of the entire Muslim Ummah. He says, "Know that Death to America slogan is rational and has strong support. It is clear it does not mean death to American nation. This slogan means death to American policies, death to arrogance." Brothers and sisters, this is a clear stance of Imam Khamenei, and I read it to you word by word. It's not about American nation. American nation themselves predominantly is oppressed, except for those, of course, who side with the oppressive system itself. And yeah, death to those as well. But what we're talking about is that the overwhelming American population is actually subjected to the same oppression in different form and shape that America carries out around the globe. So, death to America means death to the system of arrogance.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
House Republicans have impeached Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas in a historic and controversial vote. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The House voted to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas on Tuesday, 13th of February, over his handling of the U.S.-Mexico border, with Republicans issuing the chamber's harshest constitutional punishment against the cabinet secretary for just the second time in U.S. history. The vote on two articles of impeachment was 214 in favor, 213 opposed, with three Republicans voting with all Democrats against impeachment. Two Republicans and two Democrats were absent from the vote. Representative Mark Green of Tennessee, the Republican chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, said the vote holds Mayorkas accountable and called on the Senate to do the right thing and remove Secretary Mayorkas from office following a thorough trial. The effort is all but certain to crash in the U.S. Senate, where Democrats have control and a two-thirds majority would be needed to convict and remove Alejandro Mayorkas from office. Without a shred of evidence or legitimate constitutional grounds, and despite bipartisan opposition, House Republicans have falsely smeared a dedicated public servant who has spent more than 20 years enforcing our laws and serving our country. Mia Ehrenberg, a spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security, said in a statement. The statement added, Secretary Mayorkas and the Department of Homeland Security will continue working every day to keep Americans safe. In a statement, President Joe Biden called the impeachment a blatant act of unconstitutional partisanship that has targeted an honorable public servant in order to play petty political games. The successful vote follows an embarrassing defeat for Republican leaders last week when a small group of Republicans who said President Biden's border chief did not commit impeachable offenses voted with all Democrats to sink it. Republicans vowed they would try again once House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, who had been undergoing cancer treatment, returned to Washington. The Louisiana Republican returned to work this week, giving them another vote. The vote comes the same day as a special election in New York's 3rd Congressional District to replace former Republican Representative George Santos, which could further narrow the House's Republican majority. The possibility of Democrats picking up the swing seat put pressure on Republicans to move quickly with another vote. Republicans assert Alejandro Mayorkas should be charged with high crimes and misdemeanors for not enforcing immigration laws. They focus much of their arguments on the failure to detain all migrants while they await court proceedings. Mayorkas and Democrats have contended that it's a matter of policy differences, arguing that Republicans are using impeachment to score political points during an election year. They say it's up to Congress to fix the broken immigration system and allocate more money to border security. Legal experts on both sides of the aisle have also criticized the effort, saying Alejandro Mayorkas's actions fail to meet the threshold for impeachment. Last month, Republicans unveiled two articles of impeachment against Mayorkas after speeding through impeachment proceedings. The first impeachment article accuses Mayorkas of releasing migrants into the United States who should have been detained. The second article alleges he lied to lawmakers about whether the southern border was secure when he previously testified that his department had operational control of the border with Mexico, and accuses Mayorkas of obstructing congressional oversight of his department. The Department of Homeland Security has said Congress has never given the executive branch the resources and personnel needed to detain every migrant as required by federal immigration law. It also denied Mayorkas lied to lawmakers, pointing to how the department uses operational control internally. The problems with our broken and outdated immigration system are not new, Mayorkas wrote last month in a letter to the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee. In his letter, he said, "We need a legislative solution and only Congress can provide it." Mayorkas also said the push to impeach him had not shaken him. He said, "I assure you that your false accusations do not rattle me and do not divert me from the law enforcement and broader public service mission to which I have devoted most of my career and to which I remain devoted." Republican leaders went ahead with last week's nail-biter of a floor vote amid uncertainty about whether they had enough support to impeach Mayorkas. It looked like the vote was going to succeed with three Republican defections until Representative Al Green was unexpectedly wheeled into the floor in his hospital scrubs after intestinal surgery. The Texas Democrat tied the vote at 215-215, defeating the resolution. A fourth Republican also switched his vote at the last minute to give Republican leaders the opportunity to bring up the vote again, making the final vote 214 in favor to 216 against. Steve Scalise was the only lawmaker absent from the vote. One of the Republican lawmakers who broke with his party, Representative Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, said in a Wall Street Journal article last week that the GOP is setting a dangerous new precedent that would be used against future Republican administrations. Mike Gallagher announced days after the impeachment vote that he would not seek re-election. National broadcaster ABC News has also covered this story. The Republican-led House on Tuesday, 13th of February, narrowly impeached Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas over what they claim is his failure to enforce border and immigration laws, which he denies as baseless. The historic vote, only the second cabinet impeachment since the country's founding after William Belknap in 1876, has been criticized by some Republicans because it is based on policy disagreements and allegations of incompetence, not allegations of specific crimes. The impeachment articles are expected to be rejected by the Senate's Democratic majority. The House Republicans tried and failed last week to impeach Alejandro Mayorkas on the same accusations. Mayorkas deserves to be impeached and Congress has a constitutional obligation to do so, House Speaker Mike Johnson said in a statement after Tuesday's vote. Next to a declaration of war, impeachment is arguably the most serious authority given to the House, and we have treated this matter accordingly. House Speaker Mike Johnson blamed Alejandro Mayorkas for fueling the worst border catastrophe in American history. The Department of Homeland Security spokesperson shot back in a statement that, without a shred of evidence or legitimate constitutional grounds and despite bipartisan opposition, House Republicans have falsely smeared a dedicated public servant who has spent more than 20 years enforcing our laws and serving our country. Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas and the Department of Homeland Security will continue working every day to keep Americans safe. The articles of impeachment against Mayorkas passed on Tuesday, 13th of February, 214 in favor, 213 against, with a majority made up of only Republicans and three Republicans voting with Democrats against impeachment. Two Democrat representatives, Judy Chu and Luis Frankel, and Republicans representatives Brian Must and Maria Salazar did not vote. Representatives Ken Buck, Mike Gallagher and Tom McClintock, the same three Republicans who opposed the previous attempt to impeach Mayorkas last week, kept their opposition.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program again.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, as I mentioned before the break, we're going to talk about some of the jurisprudential laws related to purity. And let me start with this question, Sheikh, if you will. What's the rule, what's the jurisprudential rule when a girl's bleeding, before puberty, in fact, it starts?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The question is whether a girl hits puberty when she starts bleeding.
Yes.
And probably this is a very important question because some girls might start bleeding before the age of 9, before the completion of the age of 9, and girls who start bleeding at this age, they start wondering whether they have to, for example, start fasting or whether they have to follow the rules of menstruation or not. The answer is that if a girl actually bleeds before completing her 9 lunar months, okay, mm-hmm. lunar years, sorry. It's not a sign of puberty, and then it's not a blood that should be considered menstrual blood. It's not the blood of Hayz. And so even if it does have the properties of the menstrual blood, that blood is not considered to be Hayz because actually she has not completed 9 lunar years.
Mm-hmm.
And when she has not turned 9, okay, according to the Islamic calendar,
mm-hmm.
then whatever blood she sees is not considered to be the blood of menses, and she has to rest assured that she has not attained the age of puberty.
So if she sees or experiences that kind of bleeding, then what is that it? What's the rule there?
Yeah, the rule is that she's not supposed to pray and fast.
Uh-huh.
And when she is not supposed to do anything, like, for example, praying and fasting,
uh-huh.
then that's a kind of blood. She does not have to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
She is not supposed to fast.
I see. Okay. And, Sheikh Javed, women experience different kinds of bleeding, I think, right? What's the jurisprudential law when or if a woman is bleeding after the removal of the uterus?
Well, the removal of the uterus, I suppose it is a kind of, it involves a kind of surgical operation. Every surgical operation leads to some kind of injury because the uterus is removed through, let's say, scissors or maybe any cutting tools, and then it leads to bleeding. So when it comes to this kind of bleeding and when a woman sees this kind of blood after her uterus is removed during the operation, of course, it is ruled the same as other bleeding due to wound. Okay,
mm-hmm.
due to wound. So that wound which starts bleeding, whether it is on the surface of the skin or whether the blood comes out of the uterus, that blood is actually exempted, no matter how much the quantity of the blood. Okay, she is not supposed to perform any kind of ritual bathing or ghusl, whatever.
Or ablution. Yeah,
ablution, and of course she has to change the pad only, because it's a kind of impurity. The blood is impure, of course. But if she is praying while and bleeding while praying, she's not supposed to change the pad in the middle of the prayer because the wound.
And what happens to the prayer?
But if it,
does the prayer become null and void?
No. It does not, because the blood which comes out of the wound and the pus, these things are exempted according to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but if the blood spreads out to other places, like for example your cloth, or the blood goes to other parts, okay, you have to wash it. You have to get rid of that blood. But if, as long as the blood remains on the wound and its surrounding area, then that blood is it's exempted, and it's not. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to wash it.
Regardless of the sex,
sure,
or gender of the person, the individual, or the duty bound. Even if a man is bleeding,
yeah,
right, and sometimes the bleeding actually penetrates the cloth,
yeah,
or the clothes,
yes,
of the person who, for example, who's offering the prayer, then what happens to the prayer?
Okay, as long as the clothing remains very closely attached to the wound,
yes,
you don't have to wash it, because you wash it, yes, because that is
while you're
praying,
saying prayer.
Prayer, yes, you are praying.
So the prayer is okay.
The prayer is valid,
uh-huh,
because there's a consensus. The scholars and the religious authorities are agreed on the fact that the blood of wound is actually exempted.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to purity, according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, is it okay to perform the janaba ablution, or the ghusl of janaba, during the menses?
Mm. Well, many ladies are very much under the kind of impression, they assume that, okay, when you are in the state of janaba, you have to take action for ghusl. You should purify yourself. While the truth of the matter is that purification is not achieved as long as the woman is having having her period. When a woman gets her period and she is also supposed to perform ghusl janaba does not have any impact on her impurity. She will remain impure, and therefore the ghusl will not take place. Okay, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khomeini, perform ghusl janaba while a woman is in her menses is problematic. It's a matter of ishkal. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that means, that actually implies that purity is not achieved because the woman is already discharging menstrual blood, and of course she can wait. She can wait until she gets rid of the menses of the blood. Sure.
Right.
And then after that, she can perform one ghusl with the intention of both of the obligatory ghusl.
And obviously they have to wait because everyone is different and unique. So it varies, for example, from like 3 to 4 days to 7 days, right?
Sure.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken. 10 days. Even 10 days, yeah.
Yes, maximum.
So everybody knows, basically,
sure, yes,
right, when they become clean and get rid of the whole bleeding cycle. Sheikh Javid, a short question here. Is it permissible to worship during the menses?
Well, a lot of ladies are very much yes keen to engage in acts of worship. Of course, they do know that they cannot pray, they cannot fast, because fasting is haram and praying also haram for a menstruating woman.
Mm-hmm.
So, for a menstruating woman, it is mustahab at the time of prayer to remove the blood, change the cotton or the pad, whatever. The sanitary pad, of course, and make wudu, of course, sit on the place of the prayer and face the qibla, and of course to recite zikr, to recite dua, supplications, and also the Holy Quran. She can recite the Holy Quran, provided that she makes sure she will not touch the script of the Holy Quran, and also she cannot recite the ayat, which includes the obligatory sajda,
mm-hmm.
not the chapter, because this is a matter of discrepancy.
Right.
A lot of scholars say that okay, the whole chapter in which the ayat is there should not be recited, but of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei and also Ayatollah Sistani are of the view that only that ayah which includes the sajda should not be recited by a menstruating woman.
Mm-hmm, I see. Thank you very much, Sir Chavit. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: nearly a dozen people are killed in an Israeli airstrike on Gaza's southern city of Rafah, where the regime is preparing for a ground assault as well. Israeli forces raid Nasser Hospital in the city of Khan Yunis, where displaced Palestinians took shelter. And an Israeli airstrike on a house in southern Lebanon kills at least three civilians.